Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, January 10th, 2025, we are delighted to host a discussion on TikTok on the Clock, a Courthouse Steps oral argument program on TikTok Incorporated versus Garland, which was argued earlier today before the court. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I am an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, we will keep our introductions of our guests today brief, certainly more brief than their distinguished careers would deserve. So if you're interested, I would suggest you check out their full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us as our moderator, Casey Maddox, who currently serves as Vice President for Legal and Judicial Strategy at Americans for Prosperity. For over 15 years before joining Americans for Prosperity, Mr. Maddox's legal career focused on defending First Amendment rights of students, faculty, families, healthcare workers, and religious organizations. And I leave it to him to introduce our panelists. A last note, and then I'll get off your screens. If you have any questions throughout the program, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen. They'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Maddox, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Kayla. And thank you to the Federalist Society for making it possible for us to be able to have this conversation today. As you all know, the Supreme Court had heard argument this morning in the TikTok case, TikTok versus Garland. It was, I think, quite a spirited argument that went a little over 2 hours. And so we have a great couple of panelists here to help break down the argument, try to make sense of what we heard, and hopefully what we might anticipate coming out of the court in the very not so distant future, very likely. So Corbin Barthold, first up. Corbin is Internet Policy Counsel and Director of Appellate Litigation at Tech Freedom. Corbin clerked for, had two separate clerkships on federal district courts with Judge Stephen Meriday in the Middle District of Florida and Judge Cleland in the Eastern District of Michigan. After his clerkships, he was an associate with a firm in Los Angeles, Brown George Ross, where he did high stakes complex litigation. He then served as senior litigation counsel at the Washington Legal Foundation. And Corbin received his JD from the University of California, Berkeley School of Law, and also graduated from the University of California, San Diego. And did a bit of time at the London School of Economics as well. Christian Corrigan is our other panelist. Christian is currently the Solicitor General of Montana. Christian has previously served, Christian previously served as Assistant Secretary or Senior Counsel to the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Education during the Trump administration. Prior to government service, he was a public interest constitutional litigator at the Mountain States Legal Foundation and a fellow at the Institute of Justice. He clerked for Justice Stegall on the Kansas Supreme Court and received his BA in political science from the University of Pennsylvania before attending the University of Kansas for law school. So, gentlemen, we'll begin with Corbin first. And Corbin, I will assume some background knowledge here on the case, but I'm sure both of you will offer some thoughts on just sort of teeing up what the case is about. I'll just begin very quickly with, for those who don't know, we have a federal law passed this past year that would require ByteDance, the parent company of TikTok, require the Chinese government to divest itself of ByteDance and would require that by January 19th. If it does not, and this will be part of the conversation, that would prevent at least TikTok from being offered for sale on app stores in the United States, and perhaps would have other implications, direct implications as well for the future of TikTok. And so with that, I will kick it over to Corbin, fill in the blanks on the way that I have framed that law up. But then basically for both of the two of you, we will begin with just some general reactions to the argument that we just heard. And then we will jump into some specific questions. And I would again, just echo what Kayla said, please drop your questions in the chat so that we can get to those in just a little bit. But Corbin, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Casey. And it's good to be here. It was a bad day for quote unquote my side. I would say it was a bad morning for the First Amendment. Christian would be within his rights to say that that framing kind of begs the question, but that's how I feel. It was always going to seem like it was always going to be an uphill battle. We got a decision out of the DC Circuit, three extraordinarily capable judges appointed by Reagan and Obama and Trump, who unanimously upheld this law. Despite that clear sign that this would be an uphill slog for the petitioners, I still felt it went worse than I had hoped. I was gravely disappointed that TikTok argued first instead of the creator petitioners. That set up a first half hour of the argument of the justices kicking TikTok LLC and wondering why we should really care about them that much, and framing this case around what ByteDance is doing. And that put things completely off on the wrong foot for those of us like myself who come to this case caring about the rights of Americans to receive information and to work with editors of their choice, which is what, you know, I would think this case is about. And it was a long time before there was really any discussion of the case as framed in that way. Going into the argument, as a very rough hand, you know, it was one of those things where we were kind of going to have to run the table of everybody who we could potentially get. And instead, you know, here I am feeling sort of like Van Jones after the Trump-Biden debate on CNN in terms of my level of deflatedness. You know, I'm coming in thinking, okay, we got to see what Roberts is going to do and what Kavanaugh is going to do. Here are two gentlemen who are both very pro-First Amendment, but also very sympathetic to claims of national security by the executive. And Chief Justice Roberts came in and immediately accepted the data rationale to this law. And Justice Kavanaugh, I believe the first thing he talked about was foreign ownership restrictions. Really bad sign. And things didn't go a whole lot better from there during the TikTok time. There were a lot of arguments that I would, you know, push back on strongly that the justices seemed very sympathetic to. So Justice Kagan talked about, well, you know, is content really what's at issue here? Isn't this a law that is doing something else and then has an incidental effect on content? You know, that's a very bad sign. Roberts also went similar to Kavanaugh to ownership. Isn't this about ownership rather than content? There's this argument where CCP, what they're doing is like a psyop. It's content manipulation, and that we can somehow separate that out from the content that is actually on the platform. That is not just code for saying the way that this editor we don't like, but this editor is arranging content on the platform. And if the justices accept that that is a distinct thing from editorial control, TikTok's dead in the water. I was disappointed to see that Minneapolis Star didn't come up one time during the argument. So a lot of talk about data. Solicitor General Perloger, to her credit, really melted the data and the content rationales together and made them into this really tight ball in a way that I would propose no one has done a very effective job of doing to this point. Chief Judge Srinivasan below even went so far as to say that the government had forfeited an argument that the data rationale is really the key to this law, and Perloger really stuck those things back together. And the other side never brought up, well, Minneapolis Star stands for the proposition that if your law is singling out speech, if it's going after social media platforms, then it is ipso facto already on the back foot. It is already suspect by virtue of that simple fact. And that never came up at argument. So I was disappointed to see that. There's this tough bind for the opponents of this law, because it's pretty settled that you can't just go picking off isolated statements by legislators and say, well, that was the motive for this law, and find an invalid motive that way. And Jeffrey Fisher, who, by the way, the creator petitioners, their briefing was fantastic. I thought they did a great job. And Fisher, who should have been the first guy up at that podium arguing, once he did get up there, did a very noble effort to try and say, look, just the text of this law, I can show you the improper motive. But he was fighting on the back foot in that regard. And you actually got to the point where Chief Justice Roberts at one point said, quote, Congress doesn't care what's on TikTok. And if you're just reading the statute, maybe that's a colorable claim. If you've been like living in the world, that's insane. That's bonkers. We know that Congress people were upset about teens seeing pro-Palestine content. We know that people are upset about what they consider dangerous content on TikTok. And yeah, maybe there's dangerous content. The First Amendment protects things that disgust us. We know that from Brown versus Merchants. People were concerned about the content on TikTok, and that suffused our entire debate here. And so for anybody who opposes this law, you know, it's very disappointing and frustrating to see that kind of just, you know, for those of us on my side, it's gaslighting. We're just going to pretend that it was this sober discussion about data privacy, and that all along the legislators, that was their number one, you know, front of mind thing. Even the sponsors of the bill, Representatives Gallagher and Krishnamurthy. Gallagher said, the first concern is propaganda. That's my primary concern. And Krishnamurthy gave the theory about, oh, well, China on Douyin is showing kids STEM videos, which is really implausible. I've been on Douyin. And trying to get our teens to kill themselves. You know, these really breathless claims about the content on TikTok, which, like them or hate them, that was the interest. That was the rationale. And it just fell away during the argument. And that was just really too bad. If you're me, what you wanted to see during this argument was something that we only got glimmers of from Gorsuch and Kagan at certain points, which is what motivated this law was a fear that Americans, and particularly young Americans, are these fragile things that are subject to manipulation, and they can't think for themselves. And they're going to see content on social media. It's like the hypodermic needle effect, where it's going to change their minds about stuff in ways that scare us. Those of us watching and participating in this event, it's not us. Oh, we can think for ourselves. We're very responsible adults. But those other people, those other Americans, they're dupes, and they might be manipulated by ideas that they see and find them convincing, and that scares us. And that was the framing that you want to see if you're me in this argument. And we had a little bit of it from Gorsuch saying, isn't this paternalistic that we're assuming Americans, if there's a disclosure that says the U.S. government thinks this is being manipulated, you know, that Americans can't then think for themselves? And Kagan had a few punches in there, but it was ultimately like watching a boxing match that went 12 rounds, and the fighter you're rooting for is just getting pummeled in rounds 1, 2, 3, and 4. And then like in rounds 5 and 6, he gets a couple in there, and then he just goes back to getting completely beaten up and is covered, you know, black eyes and totally has his face rearranged by the time the final bell goes. And with that, I will cede the floor.
That was very vivid, Corbett. You're up.
Well, first, let me just thank FedSoc and my friend Casey Maddox for the invitation today, and to Corbin for participating. This is all, first, just a caveat. This is all very recent, and some of this I'm working off handwritten notes. And so if I misidentify which justice asked a particular question, I apologize. Also, disclosure, you know, my state of Montana wrote the multi-state amicus brief on behalf of 22 states, urging the Supreme Court to affirm the DC Circuit. We can get into it later. We've taken a slightly more aggressive position on some of the First Amendment issues, perhaps more in line with what Judge Srinivasan and his concurrence, or how Judge Srinivasan would have evaluated it. Top line thoughts. I may not be quite as pessimistic as Corbin, at least in terms of what could happen. That being said, I'm usually arguing against the deference giving to the federal government as a state SG. So maybe this is just a matter of perspective, that sometimes it's nice to be have the burden going for your side rather than against you. But, you know, I think that I don't disagree necessarily in terms of the analysis, but in terms of the remedy, and maybe we can discuss that later, I think there's at least an avenue for the court to maybe enter an administrative stay. I mean, the elephant in the room of all of this is that the law takes effect on January 19th. The president has the ability to extend it for, I think, 90 days. And then, of course, President Trump takes office the next day, right? And so President Trump, as all of us were getting ready to file our briefs on Friday afternoon after Christmas, the incoming president-elect files this amicus brief with the United States Supreme Court saying, well, I'm going to take over, and I both have concerns about national security, but also the 170 million people who are on TikTok, and Supreme Court, you guys should issue a stay here. So I think that was the elephant in the room. It was certainly discussed, at least at a very high level. We can get into what the court could or couldn't do, but I may be a little more less pessimistic about what might happen in terms of buying time for the 170 million users on TikTok. I think today, you know, I think about 75% of the argument centered around two main questions. The first one isn't surprising, and Corbin, I think, covered it, which is the sort of central First Amendment question, which is, does Congress's regulation of ByteDance, which is a foreign entity that is ultimately subject to a foreign adversary, implicate the rights of an American corporation, TikTok, and its American users that have First Amendment rights when they're using an end product that contains ByteDance's proprietary technology, even if TikTok USA adds to that algorithm and expands upon it. I think the Chief Justice sort of said it better later on, which was, you know, can regulation of a corporate structure be regulation of speech? Because foreign adversaries generally don't have free speech rights, but U.S. companies and users do. The petitioners argued that the burden disproportionately falls on TikTok. The Solicitor General responded and said, yes, you know, the TikTok has First Amendment rights, but the issue is sort of the back end product that comes from China, not what TikTok does with it once it's here. Justice Kagan, you know, asked TikTok, can't TikTok use whatever algorithm it wants? You know, isn't the effect on TikTok only incidental, you know, sort of because of ByteDance's choices? And that's why Congress structured the law as it did, is it sort of, there was discussion about, really, isn't this ByteDance's choice that's ultimately affecting what happens to TikTok users and TikTok USA? And so there, I think that was fairly, that tracked a lot with what happened in the briefing. We're looking at cases like Arcara. We're looking at intermediate versus strict scrutiny and saying, you know, does this implicate a First Amendment right? And is it, you know, what level of scrutiny is it subject to? And so there was a lot of discussion there. The second point where the justices really seem to drill down, and I think at the expense of the data protection rationale, was the content manipulation rationale. And this is where I think it might be a little more troubling for the government. So for those of you that don't know, Congress had various rationales in the bill for what it was doing. I think Corbin talked about it. One was data security, which sort of fell by the wayside, absent a few colloquies with Justice Kavanaugh and maybe one or two others. But the other rationale was, well, the CCP, People's Republic of China, could manipulate content because TikTok USA is subject to ByteDance's control. And the government has a fairly nuanced argument that, you know, can be admittedly difficult to make that point, which is that, well, we're concerned about the CCP manipulating content, but that's not actually content-based and therefore not subject to strict scrutiny, because the motive isn't actually to suppress certain speech and it doesn't directly regulate the speech itself. It's regulating that the CCP could manipulate content. And the Solicitor General pointed out, I think maybe Justice Sotomayor said that the CCP can still have an account on TikTok after divestiture and still publish propaganda to Americans. But I do think the court was very concerned with the content manipulation rationale and the First Amendment implications. Justice Gorsuch asked a question about foreign government-owned newspapers. There was an interesting hypo from Jeff Fisher for the creators about what if Jeff Bezos had his children kidnapped and a foreign government was forcing the Washington Post to publish things. Justice Kagan had a very interesting hypothetical about the 1950s and the Communist Party, and what if Congress found that the U.S. Communist Party was sort of too controlled by the worldwide Communist Party? You know, could you restrict that? Noel Francisco brought up that AMC movie theaters were owned by China at one point, and what if they wanted to show CCP propaganda? And so the court, was very concerned with what that might mean. I think the Solicitor General did a fairly good job of pointing out that, you know, unlike traditional media outlets, a social media application, while there is speech certainly that occurs on it, it has sort of this two-way technology where it's not just that you're reading the Washington Post that comes to your door or going to the website. You're signing up for an account. It's monitoring where you're going. And there are sort of unique aspects. And I think, you know, ultimately the government's best argument in terms of tailoring, in terms of some of the First Amendment, is that TikTok stands alone because it is the only application right now that has this sort of risk of a hostile foreign power. I do think, you know, sort of top line on the covert manipulation, there was this, you know, the government kept saying, well, even if it's out in the open, even if there was some disclosure, we're really worried about covert manipulation. And both Justices Thomas and Kagan sort of asked, well, what exactly does that mean? Justice Kagan joked that doesn't everybody know that that China manipulates TikTok? Justice Gorsuch pointed out that the Foreign Agents Registration Act makes you disclose, and that seems to be fine. The Solicitor General had a pretty apt analogy, which was that, well, you know, if you walk into a store and it says, well, 1 out of 100 products causes cancer, that isn't really helpful for helping you figure out what happens. Now, that is certainly different than manipulation of an algorithm, but I thought it was fairly effective in the moment. And then in terms of data privacy, we haven't really covered the data privacy rationale, but the question that Justice Gorsuch and some other ones asked was, TikTok, I think, you know, brought this up, wouldn't a law imposing severe penalties for sharing data with the CCP be less restrictive? And, you know, I think ultimately the government's argument that has to carry the day is it's possible that it's less restrictive and that would be helpful, but Congress and the president, in looking at the national security issue, have determined that it's not enough. And the risk is still enough that even if it is less restrictive and sort of would serve some of the same ends, it doesn't solve the concerns that Congress had. In terms of what the court could do, I think the easiest route for the court to uphold and affirm the DC Circuit would be to just affirm on the data protection rationale, because you don't get into the content manipulation rationale. The problem there is then you have to try to say, well, obviously there's a severability provision, but if there is possibly impermissible First Amendment rationale in terms of content manipulation, does that taint the rest of the act? And is that fatal to the data protection rationale? And is that severable? And so what happens if there are multiple rationales there? I think that's fairly interesting. I've talked enough. I'll stop now and we can move on to the next segment.
Fantastic. All right. So I think we have teed it up pretty well, but I'm going to ask you both to do something that's extraordinarily unfair. Let's first assume, and then we'll get to what are the other clever ways this case could resolve. But we'll come back to you first, Christian. if you see an opinion sometime next week from the Supreme Court on this, what does the vote lineup look like, do you think?
Well, let me put it this way. If it's sometime next week, let me qualify that, Your Honor. I think what I would say is if we get a very brief opinion next week that goes along the lines of what I just said, which is affirming for the data protection rationale, I think it's 9-0. I do there. If it is a messier opinion that is more complicated, that goes through the multiple rationales and you know, deals with the ultimate issue, I think let me put it this way. It might be 9-0, but there might be several concurrences and we may have a very fractured opinion, perhaps. But I think if you're saying if they're going to issue something next week, whether, you know, as we were talking about before, if it's a two paragraph opinion affirming or if it is a, you know, per curiam opinion, it's probably 9-0. But I think that ultimately depends on the route the court goes. So that's my cheating answer for you. Okay.
But overwhelmingly for TikTok from your view, I mean, against TikTok from your view, if we get an actual opinion of some kind next week.
I think so. I think, you know, for TikTok to prevail, I think it's probably going to prevail on sort of a technicality in terms of an administrative stay or something buying it more time. I think I probably share Corbin's view of the merits, just given how the argument went and the court's reluctance to get involved in certain issues.
Okay. And Corbin.
So Christian charitably told me to like at least have some hope, you know? So I was foolhardy enough to record a podcast before the argument and discuss this and have the podcast come out after. And I talked about, well, if TikTok or the creators prevail, what's your lineup? And I had said, well, you have Kagan probably writing an opinion along with Sotomayor and Gorsuch and Jackson, and then you need either Kavanaugh or Roberts. And there's several problems here, not even limited to what I said earlier about Roberts and Kavanaugh, both not really delivering from my perspective. And the one I'll point out is Justice Jackson has persistently been the most anti-free speech justice on the bench since she has joined the court. It has been quite a startling development to see that. She is reliably disappointing on Section 230, First Amendment, free speech issues. So I am not counting on that being the ruling. Given that I expect the government to prevail, I'll go to what I always thought was the other possibility, which is that Chief Justice Roberts writes an opinion as the man who wrote the OG national security trump card opinion, Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project. I always thought that was quite possible. I think it will be more than 5-4. The only question is, does Kagan or Gorsuch decide to write the sort of, this is America, you have a right to read crazy things, you can mainline propaganda if you want, opinion, the covertness doesn't change that, Lamont versus Postmaster General, whatever. Maybe you get a justice or two. Gorsuch in particular is an iconoclast. I could see him jumping at the opportunity to write a solo dissent. But I expect it will be a Roberts opinion for most, if not all, of the court. And then my hope is just that incrementalist Roberts shows up. And when we can maybe get into this more of what I think on this topic, but that it is a contained opinion where he does a good job of writing something. And I think the data rationale is the route to start getting there, that upholds this law without doing what, from my perspective, would be larger damage to the First Amendment.
All right. Who wants to take, and I'll maybe come to Corbin on this because I expect you're probably going to be pretty well connected to this. But basically, my question is, what happens on January 19th? Do we have a clear picture of what the world is going to look like on January 19th if the court upholds the D.C. Circuit? Right. So what happens to TikTok?
it was pretty clear to me that Noel Francisco was not in a position to give a clear answer about TikTok's plans, even though TikTok tried to do a sort of, oh, we're going to shut down immediately. That it seemed like a real negotiating or publicity position they were taking. From a technical perspective, the TikTok app on your phone, if you've already downloaded it, will work on January 20th unless TikTok decides. So actually, I think even if TikTok decided to take its ball and go home, the app would continue to function. It will just no longer be updatable through the App Store, and it will deteriorate and collapse in pretty short order. There is also a very broad hosting provision penalty. Well, to back up half a step, the law targets app stores and internet hosting services. It does not target TikTok directly for kind of shrewd reasons, going to the fact that you could beam a product into the United States from abroad and people can use VPNs if you really want to shut things out. Your best route is the app stores, especially given that young people are using this on their smartphones. And for optical reasons, we want to do this CCP-like thing without looking like the CCP. And if you go after ISPs, well, it's a great firewall. But the short answer is TikTok will not immediately go kaput, but you know, it's not going to stay around. It's not going to be the product that it is. If it continues to exist, it will be in some way where it is technical only. It takes a lot of effort to access it, and it will not be a popular product.
Christian, do you have other thoughts on that question?
No, I think, I think that's right. Really not much to add there. I think I generally agree with Corbin there.
I was wondering though, are there implications for like Oracle and other entities that are providing support?
Oracle needs to be concerned.
Is just like you have to remove this,
Yes. Oracle has to be concerned about whether they're covered under the hosting provision. So my understanding is the hosting provision is purposely vague enough that pretty much anybody assisting TikTok in the United States needs to be worried about liability, and the penalties are very large. Christian can correct me. I think it's like $5,000 per illicit user access or something like that, which is just a gargantuan amount of money. No, if you're partnering with TikTok in the United States and the law goes into effect, you're going to want to drop that one.
Okay. All right. So the basis for the law, we've talked about two different justifications or rationales for why Congress was trying to require ByteDance the government, Chinese government, to divest of ByteDance. You have the data security argument. You also have the sort of manipulation of content by China argument. So I'll maybe start with you, Christian. How do you see that? And talk some about sort of the way the argument went on that question. What is the rationale? What are the concerns the court has in trying to figure out to ask questions behind the rationale for what the law does?
Yeah. So just with the quick First Amendment background for folks. So if a law regulates content or regulates from the perspective of a speaker, it's going to trigger strict scrutiny, right? And so the government is arguing that, well, in this case, even though we're concerned about content manipulation, it's actually a content neutral provision. And there's also, the First Amendment case law that says even a content neutral provision can still trigger strict scrutiny. The government is essentially saying, even though it's the content manipulation that we're looking at, it is not the actual content that's being pushed. It's the person that's pushing it, which is a hostile foreign power. And it is their ability to manipulate that covertly, that is the issue. And so the examples they gave that the government has given is, sowing discord, using misinformation, sort of a making Americans hate each other, which there was a funny exchange today where I think it was Justice Alito said, well, don't they already do that? I think they're succeeding there. Doesn't social media already do that? And admittedly, that is a, and I, as I think I said earlier, that is a much more difficult argument for the government to make in terms of avoiding strict scrutiny. That feels a lot like a content-based regulation. Now, I do think they have a good argument for why it isn't, but you saw the Solicitor General struggle with those questions. And, you know, I could at least, again, that goes back to sort of my theory that they might uphold this on a limited rationale, because it felt like there were four, maybe five or more votes to say this does trigger strict scrutiny. This is a content-based regulation. The government might be able to do that, but it is a content-based regulation. And there was sort of skepticism, as I said earlier, in terms of this idea that, well, the issue is this covert content manipulation, which I think the government's argument is it's not just along the lines of what Justice Kagan said, that everybody knows the Chinese government manipulates the TikTok algorithm and owns it. It's that even with disclosure, you have the CCP on the back end of this doing things that people, you know, sort of along the lines of what the Solicitor General's argument was. You know something's happening, you just don't know which content is actually being manipulated and what isn't. And it's foreign propaganda, it's all those different types of things. Admittedly, that is a much tougher argument for the government. Again, why I'm sort of skeptical that we'll get a thorough opinion.
Corbin, do you want to add to discuss that?
Yeah. Launching off of that, saying I want some narrow Roberts opinion, you know, I'd hoped maybe he'd come in with like a Snyder versus Phelps attitude or a Stevens. He's written some very pro First Amendment decisions, but I think he's going to do something narrow and hopefully sort of data centric, because there are a lot of arguments that were floating around, the logic of which I think has knock-on repercussions that we should be very worried about. And the content manipulation one is a great example. I thought Noel Francisco was on his strongest footing at one point when he said, you know, content manipulation, if you pass a law that said, we're going to regulate you, CNN, because you're manipulating content, I think we'd all really flinch at that. I submitted an op-ed to the New York Times and they told me they were going to run it. And then something happened behind the scenes, behind closed doors. They had some kind of discussion. And then they told me they were spiking my piece. And I don't know why they did that. Well, that's manipulation, you know, and we think it's unfair, so we're going to regulate. And one thing that's important to keep clear in our minds throughout this, I've had many debates on TikTok and people often say, well, that's totally different because, and then they give some kind of distinction that's a fair distinction to the case, but is not a fair distinction to the argument before us of, is content manipulation something that can short circuit the First Amendment? It can or it can't. The fact that we don't like the CCP, and I don't like the CCP, we need to be careful that we're not picking up tools to beat the CCP that then will be laying around for further cases. So the content manipulation one, personally, it bothers me. I think the general disdain for algorithms was another one that, at least for me, is very problematic. We just did this in Moody versus NetChoice, where the court upheld the notion that an algorithm you're choosing, the order of content that people will see, that has an expressive element. Yes, it's new technology, but it is the next step in the way that we communicate with each other. And you can hate social media as a personal thing or think it corrupts the youth. We read in Brown versus Entertainment Merchants Association, you know, it's not the role of the Supreme Court justices to be deciding what corrupts the morals of the youth. They are to be upholding the First Amendment. It's addictive or it has dangerous material. That's going straight to the content. If TikTok was nothing of, but videos of paint drying, we wouldn't be here. So, there are just all kinds of ways, if they do get into the First Amendment and focus on the content as distinct from the data, that I could see things going, from my perspective, completely haywire. To her credit, and then I'll close, I thought Prologra, it was just very clever the way that she came in and decided I'm going to make the data and the content just seem completely inseparable. You can't even run the algorithm without sending the data back to China. And I have quibbles with, well, is that in the congressional record? Is that what we were doing? Are you kind of retconning what Congress did? But I'll say, if I'm going to lose, I'd rather it be something to do with data going to China than the other things I've just been discussing.
Yeah. So I think you've got, and this certainly seemed to be the case from the argument when we were talking about the data security issue. I think you had more justices, at least more on board with the general idea that this is the kind of thing that would seem to trigger fewer First Amendment questions if it's a data security question. When it's the manipulation of content question, then you sort of always would circle back around to, but you know, so this is a problem, but is it not a problem because China's involved? And so it's their involvement that makes this different. But I think there is the sense is if you're gonna pick one of those rationales, that something having to do with collecting information on Americans by China is the sort of safer rationale. Then the question becomes, all right, well, if you have two rationales, and let's assume, for example, that the manipulation of content rationale is a content-based trigger strict scrutiny. Let's assume that. If you have two rationales and one wouldn't trigger strict scrutiny and one would, now what do you do? Prologar says that, if that's the case, then the good rationale is all you need. Basically, you know, the light drives out the darkness. If you have the one rationale that works, then, pay no attention to the other rationale and we just proceed there. The other argument is, no, if you've got, you basically have to do some analysis to figure out which one was actually sort of the dominant rationale. Either one of you who wants to speak to that question, what do you do when you have two rationales? And let's assume that one of them would actually sort of pass constitutional muster, the other one would not. How does the court work through that question?
I'll jump in. So this goes back to my point that I was disappointed to see Minneapolis Star not come up. I think the case law is muddy enough that they can probably finesse this either way they want, given the law as written. Because we again run into the problem that there's this ginormous sort of record in the world of what most people really wanted to do, but we are sticking to this rule. And don't get me wrong, it has it for good reason. I mean, I don't want judges, as a matter of course, cherry picking comments that legislators made and using that to say what a law means. So it's frustrating for me because I see why we would do that. But if you just brush aside Mitt Romney saying, well, the kids are seeing pro-Palestine content on TikTok and look at the law as written, I this is a little wishy-washy. I'd say the justices will be able to figure out how to do this the way they want to do it.
Yeah, I think the case law is muddy enough. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not clear that the impermissible First Amendment or intrusion on the First Amendment interest, if they determine that, is handled the same way as, say, like racial animus. I know the case from felon disenfranchisement was cited and discussed quite a bit in terms of a state constitutional convention that was just openly
in Hunter v. Underwood, I think.
Yeah, Hunter v. Underwood. I think there's enough latitude where the court can issue, again, a very limited decision that doesn't have implications beyond sort of TikTok being, you know, a unique actor. I also think that gets back to this idea of a very limited opinion that is limited to TikTok because of its, as I think, Casey, you said a second ago, the data protection rationale limits TikTok because of its corporate structure and the sort of backdoor to the CCP, and sort of, I'll qualify this, gets you out of answering the more difficult question hypotheticals that the justices raised. I saw in the chat, you know, could Congress ban the CCP from owning the New York Times or something along those lines? And the two-way nature of TikTok and the nature of data protection and the relationship to the CCP, I think give you enough to cabinet off and would assuage some of the concerns I think that Corbyn has. And, you know, frankly, also concerns that the states have. I'll just say, you know, we have concerns about censorship of social media, too, in terms of the states. You know, my state led the multi-state brief in NRA v. Volo. We led the multi-state amicus brief in Murthy v. Missouri, the COVID social media censorship. So we actually do share some of the same concerns that that Corbyn has and folks that are on the pro TikTok, pro what you would call First Amendment side of this argument. And so I actually do agree that a particularly limited opinion here is probably what's best. You know, I certainly don't want to see, I think, as Corbyn put it, more damage done to the First Amendment than is necessary. And so, you know, I do think a limited opinion here would serve everybody's interests and hopefully sort of strike that balance. Sorry to hijack the question, Casey.
No, it's okay. I'm going to ask two more questions that'll hopefully be relatively quick, and then we will turn to the questions in the chat. So if you haven't put yours there, feel free to do so. So the last piece of this, and there may be both of these are questions that are other ways of saying other limiting ways that the court could issue a decision here. One that came up is on, let's assume strict scrutiny applies. And even if the court just decides, let's assume strict scrutiny applies, which would be a relatively easy path. We don't need to decide which of these two rationales was the one. We'll assume strict scrutiny applies. Least restrictive means. There was a conversation in the argument today about, why isn't a disclaimer sufficient? Why can't we just put a disclaimer, mandate a disclaimer on TikTok that says, kind of at the masthead of TikTok, warning, you are currently being manipulated by the Chinese Communist Party or, you know, something to that effect, right? Isn't that a less restrictive means? What's the feasibility of something like that? Is that a possible way for the court to actually even side with TikTok and say, well, this law is insufficient, or we're somehow going to narrow it? Is there any option there, basically, on the least restrictive means portion of the analysis?
I wish the justices seemed interested in that. They did not. I think Christian and I can respectfully disagree on the Prologer saying one item in this store causes cancer. That left me totally cold. I think you can put the disclosure on the app and then let Americans decide for themselves. I am totally down with the disclosure as more narrow tailoring if we're doing content. I find that quite convincing. And to not find that convincing, I think you have to go into the way I frame things at the outset. You're basically breaking faith with the American project, which is we had a First Amendment because as a nation, we decided we trust Americans to make up their own minds. The disclosure option was brought up for data. And I do think the government is on solid ground in saying, look, saying this thing might hoover up your data, that disclosure is probably inadequate because, as Prologer explained, there's a distinction between me saying, well, I, with my eyes open, have decided that I can give my data to the CCP and that's my right, versus a national security thing of the CCP has collected a mosaic of information about Americans as a population and is piecing things together or whatever. And that's a threat to the nation that is an externality independent of my independent choice. So I think disclosure is an extraordinarily strong point on content. But I don't see them even really getting there. One last thing about strict scrutiny, if it's going to overcome strict scrutiny, I do hope, and nobody brought this up at argument, so I feel pretty good about this. I hope nobody accepts the good Judge Ginsburg's notion that it upholds the spirit of the First Amendment to make the CCP be neutral or, in effect, follow the First Amendment. I think it is always dangerous when somebody says, well, I'm not upholding the First Amendment, I'm upholding the spirit of the First Amendment, that's a great sleight of hand to do mischief.
So I'll just totally agree with Corbin in terms of the first part, in terms of the disclosure rationale. I think I was just going to point out on that the national security justification that the Solicitor General brought up as it relates to data protection rationale renders most disclosure provisions inadequate. So I totally agree. And I totally agree, too, that the disclosure is a much easier lift for the petitioners here in terms of content manipulation. So not a lot to add there.
All right. So my last question before we turn over to some of the questions in the chat, several of which I think are similar on sort of First Amendment rights, foreign organizations, that sort of thing. So, but my last kind of question there is, what is the we talked earlier about the odds of, you know, vote lineup if we get a full opinion. How else does this case resolve? Is it possible we get an administrative stay? Is it possible that the court sort of in some other way, basically, you know, either remands or in some other way sort of extends the clock and gets us past January 19th into January 20th and beyond when President Trump could act? The possibility of President Trump using authority under the act to extend it for 90 days. And basically there's a day of TikTok darkness from the 19th to the 20th, but then sometime the afternoon of the 20th, it sort of comes back. What are the options on the table there that, you know, that could happen?
So one thing I think the court could do, and this is punting, but the court could say, we are going to issue an administrative stay for 30 days or whatever it is. Part of the way they could get there is say, you know, we think that at least serious questions on the merits, maybe the content neutral rationale have been raised, but sort of couch that in terms of administrative stay and give President Trump the ability to trigger the 90-day provision. Now, there was some discussion as to whether the 90-day provision can be triggered after January 19th. And I think the Solicitor General said, well, that's a question of statutory interpretation. And I'm not prepared to take a position there. Although to, I guess, challenge President Trump's ability to do that, someone would probably have to intervene in the litigation. I don't know if that would be Congress or whatever. But I can envision a scenario where the court says this implicates the First Amendment rights of 170 million people. Congress wrote this sort of unique law that goes into effect the day before the president-elect, you know, takes office. And we have this really unique dynamic. And we are going to sort of fudge the rules of administrative stays and preliminary relief in order to buy the party some more time so that President Trump likely, I would think, triggers the 90-day provision so as to give him and the parties the ability to negotiate some type of deal. It is certainly possible. Now, the court may also say the deadline's the deadline. And if the government's going to stipulate to non-enforcement, you know, it is what it is. But I think that's at least a possibility. I don't know. I'm interested in Corbin's thoughts because that was what was running through my mind the entire time as those questions were going is, how can the court avoid any type of decision here and sort of give the political branches the opportunity to work something out?
I don't know if I have anything particularly insightful to add. I had wondered going into it whether the Trump amicus brief would, I might even go so far as to say, like, hijack the argument and become this really central thing. And it just, the justices seemed completely uninterested. And as I recall, I think Justice Sotomayor was interested in whether there might be an attempt at non-enforcement or something, which is kind of that's not entirely connected. None of the justices who might have otherwise been sympathetic to this law took the bait of the fact that the Trump brief says, you know, this ban is probably happening because people are uncomfortable with the content on TikTok, right? Like, that's potentially an awkward point for the proponents of the law, but, you know, nobody seemed to to pick that up, and nor did they have to. Donald Trump is not a party to the case. Honestly, I'm kind of scratching my head. I think they will probably just put the Trump brief out of their heads and deny the petitions in their ordinary course, maybe even as soon as Monday, with an opinion to follow. But I don't say that with any confidence whatsoever. Christian could be totally right that they try to sort of spin this out to give the Trump administration a say. I really don't know.
I'm going to jump into the questions here because I know we only have 5 minutes. Several of them are pretty similar, so we'll look for some short answers here. But several folks, Sarah Reese, Jeffrey Wood, others basically asked the question about, is it really true that the First Amendment doesn't apply to foreign persons, foreign companies? There was actually, relatedly, there was a statement that I flagged right up front from Francisco. The government has no interest in preventing foreign propaganda, which just struck me as a pretty interesting direct statement to that effect. No interest. So anyway, I'll begin there. But your thoughts on basically or if you can kind of offer an answer to the question about sort of the limits of the First Amendment when it affects as it applies to foreign individuals or companies.
Well, we know this much. Judge Kavanaugh, when he was on the D.C. Circuit, wrote an opinion saying that foreign entities do not have an interest in participating in our democratic processes. We know that. Foreign resident aliens, I believe, have full First Amendment rights. And then there's this wishy-washy in between. they brought up the case involving open society. Is that what it is, Christian?
Open society. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that might be our best word on it.
Yeah. Yeah, admittedly not an expert in terms of that particular question, but I think the ultimate question here is what happened. Let's just set aside for a second. Let's assume that the Chinese Communist Party, People's Republic of China, do not, sitting in China as the Chinese government, have a First Amendment right to First Amendment rights in the United States. The question really is, well, what happens when you start acquiring ownership of entities that do have First Amendment rights or start implicating? And that's ultimately where the burden question came down. A lot of these things were, all right, well, TikTok has this algorithm that it gets from ByteDance, which ultimately seems to be controlled by China. And the end product is used by Americans, by an American company. They all clearly have First Amendment rights. But what degree of corporate structure, what degree of influence triggers First Amendment scrutiny or disclaims First Amendment protections, depending on how you look at it. And that's the ultimate question, I think, here. And I will add that there seemed to be Justice Gorsuch brought up in terms of the factual record that this is unique. For those that don't know, this was, Congress set this to be filed as a petition for review in the D.C. Circuit. So it didn't go through traditional discovery. The parties filed sealed documents, and there's a limited record that we're entitled to. We obviously have a congressional record, but there seemed to be some concern from Justice Gorsuch in terms of a secret record, but also in terms of some of the factual contentions that didn't seem to have been fleshed out related to corporate structure, related to a number of things that might actually influence the analysis. So it was kind of a unique, position here, but I'll go ahead, Gordon.
I was just going to say, Fisher massaged this by saying, look, if no Americans want anything to do with you, that's a different case, for what it's worth.
So there is, and we are right at the end of time. Mr. Singleton here had asked, basically, so data privacy rules have gotten intermediate scrutiny in the past because of the tie to commercial speech. Is this... is the difference with TikTok here really the national security interest that sort of makes this different from other data privacy questions that the court has looked at in the past?
I say yes. Short answer.
I may make myself sound ignorant here. You know, you've got Sorrell that basically says there's a heightened scrutiny for data qua information. But data privacy, I'm not sure. I think you could craft like the California style data privacy law and potentially, if it's of general application, have, you know, not have a First Amendment problem. So I would yet again mention my problem here is Minneapolis Star, that it speaks volumes that it's not a data law of general application. And if Congress had passed such a law, that would be a different discussion.
Well, I know we are coming up on time and I don't want to go over. Obviously, thankfully, the Chinese government has no access to this webinar, has no idea what we've said, to any information about any of us. But Kayla, I will hand it back over to you. And thanks again for hosting.
I'll echo those thanks to our panel. We really appreciate you carving out this section of your afternoons and being willing to listen to 2.5 hours of oral argument earlier to sort of give us this breakdown of the case and where we may be headed. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming events. With that, thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.